You are listening to Social Europe Podcast. We discuss cutting-edge thinking on politics, economy, and employment and labour with some of the most thought-provoking people around, including Nobel Prize winners and other internationally acclaimed experts. So welcome and enjoy the conversation.
This episode of Social Europe Podcast is brought to you by the Zayed Business School, University of Oxford. The Oxford Executive MBA enables current and future business leaders to make a difference in their chosen field. The part-time program is designed to fit alongside your work commitments and offers you a global network. Visit the Zayed Business School, University of Oxford website for further details.
Welcome everyone to the latest Social Europe podcast. My name is Robin Wilson, acting editor-in-chief of Social Europe. And my distinguished guest today is Thomas Piketty, professor of economics at the Paris School of Economics and author of Capital in the 21st Century and now of Capital and Ideology. Many thanks, Thomas, for giving generously of your time. If Capital in the 21st Century made you famous for one thing, Thomas, it was the equation R is greater than G. That the rise of inequality in recent decades has been linked to the excess of profit accumulation over economic growth, and so to huge rents for shareholders and chief executives. Redressing such inequality then implies taxing heavily capital assets as well as high incomes. But in Capital and Ideology, you raise a problem. You highlight how a feature of globalization has been the transnationalization of wealth and the failure of nation states to keep up, even in terms of the data they collect. So what is to be done?
Well, I think we have to rethink the way we have organized globalization. You know, the free capital flow is not something that came from the sky. You know, it was created by us. It was organized in particular international treaties. And I think we have to rewrite these treaties. You know, I think the circulation of investment is, of course, not bad in itself, but it has to come with automatic transmission of information about who owns what where. It has to come with some common tax system so that the most mobile and most powerful economic actors have to contribute to the common good at least as much as a proportion of their wealth and as a proportion of their income as the middle class and the lower social economic groups. Otherwise, you know, we have created a very dangerous system where a very large part of the population feel that, you know, they are not gaining from globalization. They are not gaining in particular from European integration. And large parts of the population feel that, you know, people at the top, large corporation, or, you know, people with high wealth, high income, get a better deal because the system, in a way, was organized so that they can just, click on a button and transfer their wealth to another jurisdiction, and then nobody can follow them. But this was organized this way. This doesn't have to be this way. This is a very sophisticated international legal system, in particular in Europe, which has made possible the fact that, you accumulate wealth by, in effect, using the public infrastructure of a country, the public education system, everything. And then you click on a button, you can go somewhere else, and nothing has been planned so that we can follow you. This has to be changed. I think this was a major mistake in the sense that I think some people, who defended this system and I voted yes in the Maastricht Treaty referendum in 1992. And so, you know, in a way, I am part of the, well, I was very young at the time. So, I am part of the many people and many voters who maybe did not realize at the time that this would lead us to a very unfair system. I think some other people also realized very well what they were pushing for. There was the view that, you know, we should put more, we should have more competition between countries so that, you know, countries will make effort to be more efficient and not to tax too much. And to, you know, to some extent, I can understand this argument, except that at the end of the day, you know, this mistrust of democracy, you know, this attempt to sort of go around democratic choices by sort of forcing the rules of the game to deliver a certain type of distributional outcomes, namely by making it possible to the most mobile and most powerful economic actors to avoid taxation, in effect. This, in the end, is a very dangerous choice for globalization and for democracy, and this is putting our basic social contract under under very dangerous threat.
Well, let's focus on the European Union, Thomas, because we're up against a race to the bottom in corporate taxation in Europe, as individual states have pursued beggar my neighbor approaches, including the one I'm a citizen of, Ireland, rather than collaborating to match collectively the power of capital. But one of the features of the current EU architecture, to which you've alluded, is the constraint of unanimity operating hitherto against action at EU level to reverse this race to the bottom. So how can it be reversed?
Well, I think we cannot wait for unanimity to change the rule of unanimity. So, you know, at some point, we need to have a subset of countries, ideally including the largest country, so including Germany, France, Italy, Spain, and, you know, as many countries as possible, but we need to have a subset of countries that sort of decide to sign a new treaty between them, whereby they will take majority rule decision on a certain number of tax decisions, for instance, to create a common tax on the profits of large corporations, to create a common tax on large carbon emissions, to create a common tax on high-income, high-wealth taxpayers. And this will be done through majority rule among these countries. Ideally, I would like this to be done through a new European Assembly that will be made up of national parliament members, you know, a little bit like the German-French Parliamentary Assembly that was created last year as part of the new bilateral treaty between France and Germany, which, by the way, illustrates that it's perfectly possible for two countries or more to stay, of course, in the European Union. You know, France and Germany are still in the European Union, of course, and to have a bilateral or trilateral or whatever, you know, treaty in order to create some, you know, special cooperation for countries that want to move ahead into more political integration and more fiscal integration. And of course, I very much hope that if a subset of countries, say Germany, France, Italy, Spain, Belgium, you know, whatever subset of countries make this proposal on the table and not only make this proposal, but actually say, okay, you know, 6 months from now, 12 months from now, you know, this will enter into force and we will take a majority rule, you know, we will have majority rule decision making to have this recovery plan with this new common tax system, and so on. I very much hope that, you know, most of the 27 countries that are currently members of the European Union will join. But probably what will happen is that at least for a certain number of years, some countries will choose to remain aside from this mechanism. And, you know, this is fine also. You know, this is what happened with the creation of the euro, of course. And you know, I'm not saying this is perfect. You know, I would prefer, of course, all 27 countries to be part of the full process of integration. And I would also like Britain to come back. And, you know, I think at some point this will happen. But if we wait for all countries to agree before moving in this direction, you know, we are going to wait forever. So I think it's very important that, you know, a subset of countries moves in this direction, and always waiting for unanimity to make progress. You know, at some point, the cost of unanimity is enormous. And, you know, we've just seen that recently with a new recovery plan, which has finally been adopted. But, you know, as we all know, it has been adopted under the threat that if, you know, the countries, you know, some countries put their veto, then there will be a separate agreement, you know, between 25 countries instead of 27. You know, now this kind of threat in order to get unanimity, you know, you cannot rule a large federation forever, you know, in this manner. You know, I think this is not working because, in effect, this takes too much time. And you know, if we decide in 3 months, in 6 months, that the recovery plan was too small, which is very likely to be the case, what are we going to do? Are we going to play this game another time with, you know, forcing unanimity to happen behind closed doors without public parliamentary deliberation with majority rule decision making? We have to move to something else.
In Kaplan ideology, Tom, you paint a fairly unforgiving picture of the evolution of the European Union as effectively the only quasi-federal entity in the world to define itself so narrowly in terms of market clearing measures rather than social policy or a political community. And this has, you claimed, fueled alienation from the European project among les classes populaires, as their socio-political aspirations have not been addressed, as evidenced by the Brexit referendum, the earlier referendum defeats on the proposed EU constitution, or indeed the controversy over Maastricht, which you mentioned. How can citizen trust in Europe be rebuilt?
Okay, let me first say that, you know, I am a European federalist. I believe in Europe. And you know, before describing everything that should be improved, you know, I think it's important to remember that, you know, European nation states have been able to build, especially, you know, after, in the decades after World War II, you know, the best social security system in the world, the least unequal social market economic system in the world. And, you know, this is a great achievement. So, you know, I'm not here to say that everything is bad in Europe. You know, that would be ridiculous. This is not at all what I think. You know, I think we've built, you know, a social system which by and large is the least unequal in history. And, you know, this is a huge achievement. But this achievement is fragile. And I think, you know, for a long time, you know, we thought that it was possible to have, you know, the welfare state within each nation state. And then the European Union would just be in charge of enforcing the common market and the free flow of goods, services, capital. I think we realize today that, you know, this is not sufficient. And, you know, if we don't harmonize tax legislation and more generally, if we don't have some public, you know, common public policy to regulate capitalism and to reduce inequality, then indeed there's a risk that the divorce between the European project and the popular class and middle class and lower middle class at some point will just destroy the European project itself. And I am, you know, very shocked by the fact that, as I show in my book, Capital and Ideology, if you look, you know, referendum after referendum, whether it is in Britain or whether it is in France, whether it is in Denmark, you know, wherever you have referendum over Europe, it's always, you know, the bottom 50% or bottom 60% income groups or wealth group or education groups that vote against Europe, and only, you know, the top 10%, 20%, 30% which vote for Europe. And this cannot be a coincidence. You know, I think the explanation according to which, you know, okay, you know, the bottom 50%, 60% group, you know, they are so nationalist, they don't like internationalist ideas. You know, I think this view is just wrong. You know, there are many examples in history where, in fact, the more disadvantaged socioeconomic groups are more internationalist than the elite. You know, it entirely depends on the kind of political project that you present, the kind of political mobilization around internationalist ideas that you present. And I think the problem is that over time, the European project has been viewed more and more as being built in the interest of the most mobile economic actors and the most powerful economic actors. And this is indeed very, very dangerous. And I think, you know, with the COVID crisis, you know, we have an opportunity to try to show to the people of Europe and the public opinion of Europe that Europe can be here to reduce inequality. But, you know, this will require some change in some deep change in the way we conduct economic policy, tax policy. You know, who is going to repay for the large public debt? You know, for now, we put everything in the balance sheet of the European Central Bank. But, you know, at some point, we'll have to discuss about who is going to pay for that. And, you know, I think there are solutions which, in fact, come also from the history of Europe itself. You know, let me remind you that after World War II and, you know, in the 1950s, many countries, including in particular Germany, invented some very innovative way to reduce a large public debt, including with very progressive tax on very high wealth individuals. And in particular, Germany in 1952 put in place a very ambitious, exceptional progressive wealth tax, which applied, you know, between 1952 and the 1960s, very high wealth taxpayer had to pay very large amount of money to the German treasury. And this was very successful in the sense that this policy, helped not only reduce public debt, paid for public investment, public infrastructure, and was part of the very successful post-war growth model. And this is, we're going to have to find something similar in the future, except that now we cannot do it alone. It cannot be just Germany or just France or just Italy. We'll have to have some common tax policy. You know, I think Europe has to show to its citizens that Europe can mean solidarity. Europe can mean asking more to those who have more. And in particular, asking more to, you know, very high wealth individual people who have more than 1 million, 2 million euros in assets, you know, should have an exceptional contribution in the coming years in order to repay for some of the COVID debt. Some proposals have been put on the table in various countries, you know, including in Germany and Die Linke, for instance, you know, has put a proposal like this on the table. Very similar, in fact, to what was actually done in Germany in 1952 and it was a big success. You know, I think at some point we'll have to adopt this at a transnational level. And I think, you know, through the kind of European assemblies that I was describing earlier, you know, it could be Germany and France. I think it would be better if it was Germany, France, Italy, Spain, Belgium, and, you know, as many countries as possible. But, you know, we'll have to change the course of Europe so as to convince, the middle class and lower socioeconomic groups of Europe that, Europe can work for them. And Europe can be here to reduce inequality and not only to be in the interest of the wealthiest citizen.
Well, continuing that point about les classes populaires, Thomas, you have also some very striking sociological graphs in Capital and Ideology, where you show how the support base for the parties of the left in Europe, which was historically among les classes populaires, has shifted dramatically in recent decades, so that they have come to represent the better educated and even, to some extent, the better off in Europe. And in the process, you say that what you call the classist politics of the past risks being substituted by the identitarian politics of nativist movements in the Europe of today. How has such a dramatic transformation come about in your view? And can it be corrected?
Well, to me, the the biggest part of the explanation, you know, has to do with the fact that we have stopped sort of discussing about, you know, the transformation of the economic system. We have stopped discussing about reducing inequality between social classes. And, you know, for many decades now, we've been sort of telling the public opinion that there's only one possible economic system, there's one possible economic policy, that, you know, governments cannot really do anything to change the economic policy, to change the distribution of income and wealth between social classes, and that the only thing that governments can do is to control their borders, control their identity. And, you know, we should not be surprised that, you know, 20 years, 30 years later, the entire political conversation is about, you know, border control and identity. But, I think this is largely the consequence of the fact that we have stopped discussing about, you know, the transformation of the economic system. So that's partly due, of course, to the gigantic historical failure of communism, you know, which has contributed, I think, to a sort of general disillusion about the idea of changing the economic system. And, you know, I was 18 at the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. And, you know, I can remember in the 1990s, I was much more sort of pro-market believer than I am today. And so I can very well understand, you know, the feeling of, you know, that came after the fall of communism. But I think that, you know, not only this has gone too far, but also, you know, we have forgotten that, okay, on the one hand, you have the gigantic failure of state communism, but on the other hand, you have all the many achievements of social democracy, you know, including a progressive taxation of income and wealth, including co-determination in companies, including social security system. And this big success of the 20th century, you know, can be taken further in the future, and you know, this is, you know, this thinking, this new thinking about a new form of economic system, more equitable, more sustainable, that we now need to have this discussion.
And in the book, Thomas, you conclude with your version of an alternative, which you describe as participatory socialism. It involves a progressive tax on all wealth, the proceeds of which, you say, should go to a capital endowment for every 25-year-old, as well as the extension of existing co-determination arrangements in Germany and elsewhere to change the balance of corporate power. You're saying this would be a way to transcend capitalism without repeating the Soviet nightmare. So can you finally elaborate on that?
So the system of participatory socialism that I describe at the end of my latest book, Capital and Ideology, which, you know, some people would prefer to call it social democracy for the 21st century. And, you know, I have no problem with this, but, you know, I prefer to talk about participatory socialism. In effect, this is, you know, the continuation of what has been done in the 20th century and what was successful. And so, you know, this includes, you know, equal access to education, to health, to a system of basic income, you know, which to some extent is already in place, but needs to be made more automatic, and, you know, educational justice needs to be more real and then theoretical, as it is too often the case. Now, regarding the system of property, which has always been sort of the core discussion about socialism and capitalism, the proposal that I am making about the system of participatory socialism rely on two main pillars. One is co-determination through change in the legal system and the system of governance of companies. And the other part is through progressive taxation and the permanent circulation of property. So regarding co-determination, So let me remind you that, you know, in a number of European countries, including Germany, Sweden, starting around the 1950s, we've had a system of so-called co-determination where 50% of the seats in the governing boards of large companies will go to elected representative of employees, of workers, even if they don't have a share in the capital of the company, and the other 50% of voting rights will go to shareholders, which means that if, in addition, the workers and employees of the company have a capital share of, say, 10 or 20%, or if some local government, regional government, as it happens sometimes in Germany, has a share of 10 or 20% in the capital stock of the company, then, in effect, this will shift the majority, even if you have a private shareholder who has, 70% or 80% or 90% of the capital of the company. So this is quite a big change as compared to the usual rule, one share, one vote, which is supposed to be the basic definition of shareholder capitalism. And, I can tell you that in France or in Britain or in the US or, in other countries where this system was not extended, shareholders, don't like this at all, don't like this idea at all. But in the end, this was pretty successful, I think, in Germany or Sweden. I don't want to idealize this system, but, I think this has to some extent made it possible to involve workers in the long run strategy of companies in a way that, is not perfect in Germany or Sweden, but I think is a bit better at least than in France or in Britain and the US. And I think we can go further in this direction. So the first pillar of participatory socialism that I propose in my book is to say, okay, let's extend this co-determination system to all countries. All countries in Europe to begin with, but all countries in the world ideally. Let's also extend it to small companies and not only the large companies where it applies in Germany. In Sweden, it applies to a bit smaller companies, but the very small companies are included. Let's apply it to all companies, no matter the size. And let's go further by assuming, for instance, that within the 50% of the vote going to shareholders, a single shareholder cannot have more than 10% of the vote in large companies, over 100 workers. The general idea is that we need to share power. We need more participation by everyone. We live in very educated societies where, lots of people, lots of wage earners, engineers, managers, technicians, have something to contribute to decision making in the company. So, when you are in a very small company where there's, only one individual put the small capital to create the company and hired one or two people, you can see why you want, the majority of the vote with the one individual, the founder of the company. But as the company gets bigger and bigger, you need more deliberation. And you cannot, be in a system where one individual, because he or she had a good idea or was very lucky at the age of 30, is gonna concentrate all the decision-making power at the age of 50, 70, 90, including in a huge company with thousands of or tens of thousands of workers. So that's the first pillar of participatory socialism, as I understand it. We start from the co-determination system as it has been applied, and we try to extend it. The second pillar is about progressive taxation. So again, we start from what has been experimented during the 20th century. And, some countries like the United States, for instance, have gone pretty far in the direction of progressive taxation. The top income tax rate at the time of Roosevelt was 91%, on average between 1930 and 1980 in the United States, it was over 80%. And in fact, it was very successful in the sense that the productivity growth at this time, was much higher than what it has been since the 1980s. So, the view that, in order to get more innovation, more growth, you need more and more inequality at the top is simply wrong if you look at historical evidence. you know, the big lesson from history that I push in my book, Capital and Ideology, is that prosperity, economic prosperity, historically comes from equality, and in particular, equality and education. And in particular, it is because the United States was the most educated country in the world in the middle of the 20th century, with, you know, 80-90% of generation going to high school at a time when it was maybe 20-30% in Germany, France, or Japan. This is because you had this huge educational advance that the United States were also the most productive economy. So the view that was put at the time of Reagan that in order to get more growth, innovation, you should have more concentration of income and wealth at the very top is simply wrong. You know, the top income tax rate, top inheritance tax rate were divided by two by Reagan, but in fact, the per capita national income growth rate was also divided by two in the three decades after the Reagan reform. So I think we have to return to more progressive taxation of income and wealth. And so this is the second pillar of participatory socialism that I propose in my book. And I propose to have a large progressive taxation, not only of income and inherited wealth, but also of wealth itself on an annual basis. So as to avoid excessive concentration of wealth at the top. And indeed, so as to pay for a minimum inheritance for all. So for instance, you know, I propose 120,000 euros at the age of 25. This is still quite far from complete equality. You know, in the system I propose, the people who today receive 0 euro, which are basically the bottom 50% or even the bottom 60% of societies, you know, they receive zero. With the system I propose, they will receive 120,000. And the people who today receive 1 million, after the tax and everything, you know, they will still receive 600,000, which is, you know, less than 1 million, but a lot more than 120,000. So we are still very far from equal opportunity, you know, which is a theoretical principle that people pretend that they like it. But, you know, in practice, when it comes to concrete proposal, many people have a problem with equal opportunity, but you know, I think we need to go in this direction, and this proposal that I am making, you know, is actually a very moderate proposal. And if you want my opinion, I think we could go further than that. Now, this platform, this is not something that I you know, should. I'm not saying this should be applied, you know, next week in every country directly. You know, this is a sort of general view of how the economic system should be transformed in the long run. This kind of economic system that I am describing, that I call participatory socialism, you know, of course, is different from the kind of welfare capitalism or social democratic capitalism that we have today. But I would say it's very much in the continuation of the transformation that already took place over the past century. So, you know, the welfare capitalism or social democratic capitalism that we have today is very, very different from the kind of colonial capitalism that we had in 1900, 1910, you know, where the right of property owners, both at the world level, colonial level, but also at the domestic level, were much, much stronger. You could fire a worker when you want, fire a tenant when you want. You know, this has nothing to do with the system we have today. So there is a long run process toward more equality. There is a long run process toward justice. You know, I believe in the learning of justice, and this comes with a more balanced distribution of economic rights and social rights between owners and non-owners, with a regulation of property and the transformation of property relation. And I think this evolution will continue. It has already been very strong in the past century, and I think it will continue in the future. And this is the discussion that we need to reopen in order to shift the political conversation away from identity politics and border control toward economic and social progress and transformation.
And you do make plain in the book, Thomas, that this agenda you set out for a transformation in terms of the transfer of capital and of political power from capital towards les classes populaires is only, in your view, the opening of a wider discussion which you're keen to initiate. And I hope that today's interview will help to foster just such a discussion. Thank you, Thomas. You've been listening to Professor Thomas Piketty, author of Capital and Ideology. Many thanks, Thomas.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you don't miss future episodes by subscribing to Social Europe Podcast. You can also read our articles on www.socialeurope.eu and follow us on Facebook and on Twitter at Social Europe. Until next time.